Welcome to the Public Rally. I became aware of the artist Dred Scott back in 1989 when President George H.W. Bush called Scott's work entitled, "What is the Proper Way to Display the U.S. Flag," quote-unquote, disgraceful. And the United States Senate took subsequent action. 20 years later, Scott created another participatory work of art through the lens of an unflattering aspect of American history. Scott's Slave Rebellion reenactment, where hundreds of participants echoed the chants of the formerly enslaved to recreate the 1811 slave revolt outside of New Orleans that spanned 24 miles over a two-day period. We are honored on the Public Rally to be in conversation with this brilliant public intellectual. Dred Scott, welcome to the Public Morality.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the conversation today.
How does Dred Scott define artistic expression?
Well, I'm an artist, and, you know, it's like, you know, certainly, you know, for the past 70 or so years, art has had a really broad range. I don't just do painting. I don't just do sculpture. Art can be just about anything. That doesn't mean that everything is art. But, you know, I work in performance, I work in video, I work in photo-based work, I work in installation, I work in sculpture. For me, the question is, what's the content of the work? And a lot of my art actually is asking an audience to rethink and think about some of the cohering ideas of American society, often to rethink and challenge some long-held assumptions, and sometimes to think about how the world could be radically different and far better.
Examining the American narrative, would you say that's part of your through line that that connects your work, sort of looking at the absurdity of the American narrative?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like I make art about the country that I grew up in and I live in and I know most about. And I think most artists do. You know, it's like art is really, you know, it's a product of the mind of the artists at the times and the place that they live in. And I've grown up in America, and a lot of my work looks at and uses and deploys U.S. history, because I think you can't understand the present without understanding that past. How do we get here? And so that has been a through line. It's not all of what I do, but it has been a very important topic over, you know, 30 years of my work to sort of deploy and mine U.S. history.
Speaking of that 30-year trajectory, you burst on the national scene, at least for me, I'll say it like that, when President George H.W. Bush, you know, called your work, quote-unquote, disgraceful. Could you offer our listeners a retrospective of that moment? I'm particularly interested in what that moment felt like for you personally, in addition.
Yeah, well, you know, George H.W. Bush one, is a great art critic. I mean, if he doesn't like my work, then I'm doing something right. This was a guy who was the former head of the CIA and a president at the time of the United States. And this is a country that was founded on slavery and genocide. The piece that he specifically didn't like was an artwork called "What is the Proper Way to Display a U.S. Flag?" And it was an installation for audience participation. It consisted of a photo montage, which some people might think of as a collage, but it was actually all on one piece of paper, that had text that said, "What is the proper way to display a U.S. flag?" And then below that was an image of South Korean students burning American flags, holding signs that said, "Yankee, go home, son of a bitch." And below that was an image of flag-draped coffins coming back from Vietnam in a troop transport. And then attached below the photograph to the wall was a shelf that had books that people could write responses to the title of the work. And below that was a 3x5 foot flag that people had the option of standing on. A lot of people did, some people didn't, but people interacted with the work. And Bush thought that transgressive use of the flag was something that was offensive to him. And I think, well, all right, that, you know, if the president of the United States doesn't like what I'm doing, then I must be doing something right, right on to that. And it's a job I want to do for the rest of my life.
Well, not only the president of the United States, correct me if I'm wrong, but the Senate took meaningless action to deploy your work. And moreover, you had a number of responses in the writing that was provided in the artworks. I mean, some of it was very complimentary, but some of it was rather, let's just say, vitriolic. And I'm wondering, because you were young at the time. Well, you're still young, but you were really young at the time. Can you recall how you were feeling just about some of the myriad responses that you were receiving at the time?
Yeah, well, first off, just to clear up, I ain't young no more. I mean, you and I'm looking at you. We each have some gray hair in our beard, so I'm officially old now.
It's called
But
Grecian. I put Grecian formula in my beard to look this way. It's really not like.
Okay. Well, I was 24 back at the time. That was 1989, and that was a long time ago. So, all right. I mean, the thing is, first of all, Congress's action in the Senate wasn't meaningless. They outlawed the artwork, which was very serious. They passed this law that was about far more than my artwork, but actually to effectively make patriotism compulsory, that people could not criticize the flag. And that is one step away from saying people can't criticize the government. That's very serious. They were effectively ripping up their First Amendment to say that the only permissible view of the American flag was that you could wave it on a pole. And that's very dangerous. And so when I and others defied that law as a part of political protest, we burned flags on the steps of the US Capitol. That went straight to the Supreme Court, and they took that case in an effort to try and put us in jail. And so, and as part of sort of making public opinion that this country was not going to tolerate people critical of its flag and its government. And so that was very serious. Going back to the artwork was an installation for audience participation, and a lot of people participated. And so, as you pointed out, some people were very supportive. There were some people who said things like, the police shot my brother and then walked over to kick over his body to make sure the nigger was dead. That cop was wearing a flag. Thank you for the opportunity to stand on this flag, Dred Scott. And so there were people that were writing from bitter, painful experience of what this system does to them, and talking. And this artwork gave those people an opportunity to talk about this flag and U.S. patriotism in this country, in a forum that they normally would be shut out for, because normally the people who got to talk about the flag were the people that would wave the flag, that would consider themselves very patriotic. And so there were also a lot of comments like that. And then there were comments that were, basically death threats and people telling me to go back to Africa, which frankly, I would love to go to Africa. Africa sounds pretty hype to me. But it's like the racism that was, like behind that, go back to the jungles of Africa. It's like, well, that's a conversation that the racism that was brought out by somebody talking about what the history of the US flag represents was something that they felt that I should be grateful to have my ancestors have been enslaved here, and that I should be thankful that I'm still here. And I think that I would much rather talk about what's the legacy of this country and giving a platform for people to have a very visceral and visible debate over that question, because it wasn't just me saying the flag. It was actually me opening up a question for people to have a broad debate, and a lot of people did. And from just ordinary people in the housing projects up to the President of the United States in Congress.
One of the things that struck me about that moment is just sort of the irony that you had the sitting president of the United States subjectively bemoaning your work for you subjectively operating out of the lens that you saw the American narrative. I mean, that just seems to be an irony to me. I wonder how you saw that.
Well, I saw it as that, people with power and sort of the common, sort of not exactly common sense, but the backing of the prevailing norms of society, they have the ability to say all sorts of things and get away with it. And so it's, in most times, people, radicals and revolutionaries aren't actually given a platform on national television or in a major museum to sharply talk about what the experience of people whose, children are murdered by the cops or brothers are murdered by the cops. Normally, that isn't sort of part of the debate and discourse. And that's what was so transgressive and disruptive about this work, which was very beautiful, I thought. And so, the fact that I'm seeing this, so-called the most powerful man in the world having to come down off his throne and get in a debate with a previously unknown 24-year-old art student in a Midwestern art school, I'm like, all right, let's get it on. Let's talk about this. Because this is actually, sort of exposing the fragileness of this system that you can't even tolerate, again, an unknown art student in Midwestern art school in a student exhibition saying, wait, what does this flag represent? It's sort of as if people might see that the emperor has no clothes.
And these are my words. I felt then, and 30 years later, thereabout, I still feel the same way. There was a disingenuous aspect to the argument in that the president and all sort of assumed, and this is one of the challenges I think of the American narrative, that they assumed that there's a homogenized way that one should view America, and anytime one offers the contrarian perspective, they're out of step. And so you sort of at 1989, you became, in my view, Exhibit A, for this ongoing culture war debate. Now, I wonder how you saw that.
Yeah, I mean, I made the work in 88, and it became the center of controversy in 89. And as a relatively young person, I had no idea that 30, 35 years later, the culture wars would be being waged the way they are, that there would be a man named Colin Kaepernick who was a great football player who'd be thrown out of his job for criticizing, what this country does and using the platform of the national anthem to do that, but then be told, look, you can't work because you didn't basically salute the flag. And so, I had no idea where all this would go, but I did know that it was actually getting at the heart of some big questions. And I don't think it was, I think that the people who run this country actually desperately want people to believe their narrative. It's not that they don't think that there aren't people that dissent, and I mean, they know they brutalize people. They know they exploit people. They know they drop bombs on people all around the world. They know that they, I mean, right now it's the people that are, say, suffering from COVID disproportionately are, Black and Indigenous, and the people who run this country know that. They know this country was founded on slavery and genocide. But they want people to actually think that everybody can become rich and powerful, and that's what you should be. You should be an American. You should have aspirations of being, the CEO of something. You should want to be Jeff Bezos. You should want to be, Biden or Trump, And I think that sort of belief in America has been a very useful tool for a country that exploits millions and millions of people in this country and billions of people around the world.
Now, you had referenced earlier the Supreme Court case, and that was United States versus Eichmann, correct?
Yeah, U.S.
Okay,
versus Eichmann,
yeah.
yeah.
And so, and that was, and the court sided with you that these laws were unconstitutional because because they were an encroachment on free expression. My question for you, we've seen it on a number of occasions within the American narrative when the federal government has found discomfort with the protections guaranteed in the First Amendment. I'm thinking, from Billie Holiday singing Strange Fruit and banning certain books like Huckleberry Finn to Beloved, your work and others. And so it seems, at least to me, that the artists, and I'm using that in that larger sense that we started this conversation with, is uniquely positioned to test whether this country is truly committed to its original precepts. And I wonder how you saw that.
Well, I think this country is very committed to its original precepts, and that is that a small handful of white enslavers and their descendants and friends should rule the country. It's very committed to that. I don't think it's all that committed to, quote unquote, all men are created equal, because the people who wrote that actually owned people, and they were writing the laws, and the U.S. Constitution was written by enslavers and friends of enslavers to define the legal and political framework of a society whose economic foundation and roots were in slavery. And so it's this, belief of, we the people and everybody has rights and even people can have dissenting views, that didn't really extend to people to seriously undermine and challenge those other principles of the right to own property, including human property. And so, I think that pointing out Billie Holiday, I mean, that's actually really important. Her song Strange Fruit is a beautiful, beautiful song, but it was a cry against the scourge of lynching, which was terrorizing the Black community and had been, since the time of the Civil War. And, you know, she was hounded and harassed to almost the point of causing her death. And so, you know, it's sort of the fact that songs like that and artists like that and other the artists you talk about right now with Toni Morrison and even the 1619 Project, which was, you know, edited by Nicole Hannah-Jones, which you're broadcasting out of North Carolina, which she was denied tenure in that state, you know, being a Pulitzer Prize winner and a MacArthur Genius. And she was asked, you know, well, what credentials do you have? And so it's this 1619 Project is basically being fought over because this country and powerful people in it don't want that history taught. And so I think the artists have a important role to raise these voices, but it's the question is not, you know, will this country live up to some mythical ideals, but is more, can we use the ideals, which are just a crumb and a slice of a founding document, to fight for rights that can actually get to justice? I don't think that I'm not looking to sort of perfect America or make it live up to some supposed ideals. I think it is doing exactly what it's intended to, and that's causing hell for millions and millions and millions of people. And I think we need to get beyond that.
I'm speaking with internationally known artist Dred Scott about his art and his activism. You were born Scott Tyler. At what point did you take on the name Dred Scott? And would you share with our listeners the history behind the name, if you would?
Yeah, well, you know, my parents were good people. They would not name somebody Dred Scott, but I'm a professional troublemaker. So when I was becoming an artist, I said, well, I need sort of a nom de plume or a nom de guerre. And, you know, it's like, and to be honest, I was young. I was like 23 when I took the name. And you know, I was into punk rock, and I had friends that were named like Virus X and Lee Ving. And you know, there were a lot of names that had puns in them and stuff like that. And so, but I wanted a name that actually really talked about American history. And so my parents named me Scott. I had dreadlocks at the time. The few dreads that were in Chicago or that were in my circles were named Jimmy Dread or Steve Dread. And I'm like, yo, I'll be Dred Scott. That's perfect. Because anytime anybody says that name, they're going to have to think about the 1857 Supreme Court case, Dred Scott versus Sanford, which, as part of the ruling from the opinion of the Chief Justice at the time, there were no rights that a black person had that a white man was bound to respect. And I would really encourage people to read that Supreme Court ruling, because it is, you know, it's like it's 41 pages. You can get it for free on the Library of Congress, you know, website. And it is the most straight up, well thought out argument for white supremacy I've ever read. And it's deeply rooted in the US Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and US law and custom to that point. Taney explicitly said basically the founding fathers did not think of Africans and descendants of Africans as citizens or, frankly, even human beings, and that, you know, Americans could do with black people and Africans whatever they wanted, and that was their role on earth. And so, you know, I think that you know, wanting people to think about that history when they heard my name, the name of an artist, referencing that was something that, you know, was important to me.
How do you deal? I'm assuming over the years, not just with the American flag artwork that you did, we talked about earlier. How do you feel when you receive pushback that you may be rewriting history? I'm assuming you've gotten something or some variation of that theme. How do you respond to that?
Well, yeah, I mean, some people want me dead, and some people accuse me. I mean, like most recently, I did an artwork called White Male for Sale, which was an NFT, which we could talk about if you want. For your listeners who might not know, NFTs are called non-fungible tokens. It's a new internet thing where people could basically have digital artwork and have it be authenticated digitally online. And I mean, I don't want to go into all of why I made it, but basically, I had a white guy on an auction block in Black Brooklyn and a video of that, and then it was auctioned off at an auction house named Christie's. And so, when I put this out, a lot of people told me that this was unfair, that it was rewriting history, that it was not the truth, that actually, what I really missed was that Africans enslaved tons of Europeans, millions and millions of Europeans were enslaved, and I just didn't know that. And I'm like, oh, well, Yeah, maybe I missed that. If you could show me the documents where there was this massive enslavement of white people, I'd love to know that, but it's just not true. And so the question with a lot of people that are pushing back against what I'm saying is either they are ignorant, which sometimes is true because in this society, a lot of people don't know things. And by saying ignorant, I'm not saying they're stupid, but a lot of people, you know, if you grow up in American school, you're probably not going to learn, say, about the Dred Scott decision. You're not going to learn. I mean, over half people in the United States don't know that the cause of the Civil War was over slavery, even though it wasn't a moral question, but that's what it was being fought about. And so, you know, when basic foundational things aren't known, some people are genuinely ignorant and are upset that I'm sort of exposing something they don't know. And then other people, I think, do know the history and are trying to preserve this, you know, a society that again is both founded on slavery and genocide, but has white supremacy rooted in its sort of cohering ideas. And so when I make work that challenges that and challenges that history, you know, people sometimes don't want that brought out. I mean, it's, you know, the people who like acute, like when a lot of monuments of white supremacist Confederate, you know, leaders were taken down recently and have been challenged and subject to criticism. And a lot of people got jumped out and said, well, you guys are trying to erase history. And it's like, well, actually, no, we're trying to focus on history. It's just that the history that you're trying to talk about is the upside down, twisted version of it. And I think, say, the people of Germany have done a very good job of talking about the horrors of fascism without having monuments to Hitler, without having highways named after Goebbels, without having schools named after Heinrich Himmler. You know, they've done a really good job at focusing on how bad fascism was and that that should not be repeated. Whereas in America, we've done a terrible job of focusing on how bad enslavement was and white supremacy is, even though there are all these damn monuments all over the place. And so when I'm talking about, you know, what I address in my work, I think that like mining the history, say, of slave rebellions, which is really, really important and foundational to understanding America, some people get freaked out because it's actually challenging the cohering ideas that are operative today, not just about the past, but of how life should be today.
Oh, that's a perfect segue because I wanted to talk about the slave rebellion reenactment you did in 2019 and talk about that and talk about that project and give us some detail if you would.
Okay, well, Slave Rebellion Reenactment was a project that reenacted the largest rebellion of enslaved people in the history of the United States. That was a rebellion that happened in 1811 outside of New Orleans. And the people there had this audacious and bold plan to rise up, overthrow the system of enslavement, seize all of Orleans territory, which is modern day Louisiana, and set up an African republic in the New World, which would have basically outlawed slavery, much the way they did in Haiti, which the Haitian Revolution was actually a point of inspiration for many of the leaders of this 1811 revolt. And so I reenacted this as a community engaged project with 350 Black and Indigenous reenactors. We marched over the course of 2 days. We marched 24 miles on the outskirts of New Orleans, on the locations that this original rebellion happened, and we were in period costume, and we chanted, "On to New Orleans, freedom or death. We're going to end slavery. Join us." We had machetes and sickles and muskets and sabers. It was an army of the enslaved, and if you wanted to end oppression and exploitation, this was a beautiful, beautiful sight. If you wanted to maintain a white supremacist view of the past, it was a little bit unnerving and scary. But it was amazing, and it was tremendously uplifting and powerful for the people who were embodying this history, as well as for a lot of the audience members who saw this. And then we interrupted the historic timeline because this 1811 revolt, even if you don't know that history, you know that there was no African Republic in what's modern day Louisiana. And so it didn't end with that. And we interrupted the historic timeline, and we sort of the rebel army successfully got to the city of New Orleans, and we ended up in Congo Square, which was a place that was important for preserving of African culture. The Congo Square and a few places like it were places where Africans and Afro-descendant people could gather on Sundays, and in traditional dress and with traditional song. And so the rhythms that laid the foundation for modern day, what we think of as American music, you know, initially starting with jazz, but also then going up to blues and hip hop and rhythm and blues and rock and roll and R&B and bounce and trap and trance and disco and funk, all that is because of places like Congo Square. And so we ended up there and did a cultural celebration there. So It was an amazing project, and I do want to say again, we're talking about New Orleans. It was a project. I'm sorry, talking about you're from North Carolina. It was a project that was started as a residency when I was at the McCall Center, which is in Charlotte, North Carolina. Even though the project took place in New Orleans, a lot of the initial support happened at this beautiful art center in Charlotte called the McCall Center.
So for you, it culminated in Congo Square, which you see is sort of an epicenter for American musical culture. Would that be fair?
I would say you don't get American musical culture without Congo Square and a couple places like it. Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, I don't know if it's an epicenter, but yeah, it is. It without that, music as we know it doesn't exist.
How about a epicenter?
Yeah, good enough. We'll take that.
All right. One of the things that fascinated me about the slavery reenactment, that slave revolts just in general, I'm assuming they are not high on the list of AP history curriculum, but given that, the slave rebellion that you depict in 1811 is among the lesser known slave revolts. Any thoughts why that may be?
Well, I mean, if you ran a country that was exploiting and warehousing black people in prison, would you tell people that people rose up to try and overthrow them and almost succeeded? I mean, that would not be history that would be told. And so, I mean, look, in 1811, this rebellion, all slave revolts, and slave revolts were common. I mean, 10% of the transatlantic voyages carrying enslaved people had mutinies that were on them. There were over 250 documented slave rebellions of 10 or more people in the United States. But they were all long shots. They all were real long shot to succeed, but this one could have succeeded. And there were some real reasons why it could have, but also some real reasons why it didn't. And a lot of that, there was a lot of luck in why it didn't succeed. And so, but the enslavers were terrified. They knew they could have lost everything. And so from day one, they started telling stories that, oh man, there's nothing to see here. You got to remember in 1811, New Orleans, and more specifically, Louisiana is not a state. It's going to become a state a year later. And so if you're applying for statehood, it doesn't help your application to say, oh yeah, our Negroes are revolting. And so they kind of downplayed it, and the governor sort of said, yeah, nothing to see here, nothing to see here. And there was no internet at the time. And so the news stories that were reported were all from the perspective of the news stories that reported in New Orleans. So even though this rebellion was reported as far away as London and New York and Pennsylvania, Philadelphia, the stories were all just basically cutting and pasting the stories that were printed in New Orleans. And so it wasn't until very recently, specifically 1995, when some people's historians, a dude named Leon Waters, who had family history with that rebellion, actually published a book that talked about this is what the history was, that scholars started to focus on it. Because to the degree anybody was looking at slave rebellions, and those mostly weren't looked at until the mid-1940s, there wasn't a lot in the historic record that would have pointed people to this being a super significant one. And that's a real sort of crime and tragedy. And so I'm happy that there's more scholarship being focused on it, and that this artwork that I did has started to focus more people's attention on it.
The founding fathers' definition notwithstanding, assuming that freedom is certainly, and liberty is part of natural law, would it stand to reason that the slave revolts are an organic process to the institution of slavery, or organic response, I should say, to the institution of slavery?
Yeah, I mean, I think, wherever there's oppression, there's going to be resistance. And whenever people were enslaved, they fought against it. And that's just as long as you're going to exploit people, expect them to hit back as soon as they can. And so I think that, I think not only are they natural, but they're righteous. I mean, the people that were enslaved had the most radical view of freedom in the United States at that time. I mean, you talked about AP history. Children are taught to study the words of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson and stuff to talk about freedom. Well, modern day people would not understand freedom as being consistent with enslaving and owning people. But those guys did. The enslaved, on the other hand, saw that the big barrier to freedom at the time was slavery, that you could not get to a just society unless you got rid of slavery. And they came up with a plan to get rid of it. It was an audacious and bold plan, but that was what was righteous. And so people like, you know, Charles Delange, who was a leader of this 1811 rebellion, but also Cook and Kimana and Mary Rose and Gilbert, those are the people who should be studied. If you want to talk about freedom, if you want to learn about freedom, if you, and even democracy, those are the people you should study, not people whose very concept of freedom was predicated on owning other human beings.
Between the distinctions of art and activism, and sometimes I would assume that you hold that they sometimes blend together, is it your goal to create discomfort with your work, seeing discomfort is sort of the forerunner to change? Or is just discomfort just, again, that sort of organic byproduct whenever a portion of the American narrative has been glossed over that is finally being lifted up authentically?
Well, I mean, I think so, you know, there's discomfort and there's discomfort. I mean, to, you know, Malcolm X talked about, well, when you know, and leaving aside questions of the analogy of house slaves and field slaves.
Yes.
I mean, because I think all slaves were enslaved and, you know, the house slave didn't have it good. But his point was like, look, when some people saw the slave master's house on fire, they wanted to go get water and hoses and
right.
put it out. And other people said, nah, man, we wish for a strong wind to burn it down. And I think that, you know, for some people, slave rebellions are uncomfortable because they challenge a particular history. But for other people, it's like, damn, that's about freedom and liberation. So it's why, you know, it's like, you know, in you know, when the freedom riders got on those buses and they got their heads knocked in, some people, and it was a minority, thought, man, this is freedom. This, we're going to get free. Many people, including a lot of Black folk, were like, nah, man, this is not right. It's I'm uncomfortable about this. And certainly a lot of white supremacists were like, no, this is not happening. But I think that the questions you have to look at who's uncomfortable and by what. And so for me, looking at slave rebellion, I think armed Black freedom fighters, people fighting against enslavement and the descendants of people fighting against enslavement, that's not uncomfortable. That is liberatory. That makes your heart sing. And so the question is, where are people's feet planted when they see something that feels uncomfortable? And so, yeah, I do think that sometimes discomfort is important. And I do think sometimes my art makes people, including people that I overall agree with, a little uncomfortable. I take them outside of their comfort zone. I don't shy away from that. But I also encourage people, get comfortable with radical change.
You know, as you were giving that answer, I was sort of thinking, I was actually thinking in the contemporary context of how some people are viewing the Kyle Rittenhouse trial and well, you know, I think you can. I can already just give this to you, but the idea, and these are my thoughts. The idea of a armed person of color being driven by a parent crossing state line to be in the midst of a demonstration. I don't. Anyone that, at least people that I know, would not see him walking away with a not guilty verdict. And I wonder if you had any thoughts linking your work to that contemporary moment that I just referenced.
Yeah, Black man crossing state lines to be a part of a demonstration that's armed. He ain't gonna even get no trial. He gonna be dead. Black people get shot for just being Black. You know, I mean, it's. You look at Philando Castile, the cop asked him, look, can you hand me your license? He says, I'm going to, and I just want to tell you, officer, I've got a registered handgun that's in my glove compartment. He got shot for that. Walter Scott, you know, in South Carolina, he got shot in the back while fleeing. Black people get shot without being armed. If you talk about a Black dude with an AR-15 walking around in public, that ain't going to end well. And so there ain't going to be no trial. And I think with my work in Kyle Rittenhouse, I mean, I think they're sort of the polar opposite. Kyle Rittenhouse is a white vigilante stalker going into the midst of a demonstration of Black people fighting for justice for Jacob Blake, who was shot in the back by a cop. And people were upset that this was going down. And Kyle Rittenhouse crosses straight lines as a vigilante and gets backed up by militias and the police. And so that's what's happening now by a judge that even says the people he murdered can't be called victims. And so look, this is my work talks about a system that has judges like that and has situations where white teenagers can go play vigilante killers and get the support of the President of the United States. And so my work is talking about that, is exposing that. And I just think it is a sign of the times that this sort of, a murderer with an illegal weapon is being talked about by some people as a hero, and that large sections of the media, while I think uncomfortable, are not actually just saying, this dude is a murderer and a vigilante, and he should be serving life in prison.
I'm fascinated by a quote that is attributed to you, and I think this sort of gets at a lot of what we've been talking about thus far. You said you can't actually understand American society if you don't understand slavery, and you can't understand slavery if you don't understand slave revolts. Say more about that, please.
Yeah, I said it. Of course, yeah, I said it. Chris Rock, and
You're
no,
right. Yeah.
it's I think that's really true, actually, is that you don't actually get Kyle Rittenhouse. You don't get Derek Chauvin murdering George Floyd without slavery. You don't get disproportionate deaths of black people by a virus without slavery. You don't get all of that. But you also don't understand America without, and you can't understand slavery without understanding slave rebellions. The point you were talking about earlier, where you said that this is an organic response, and I was saying, well, yes, it is absolutely organic, but also it's widespread. People were not slaves. People were enslaved, and they were resisting all along. Now, sometimes that resistance was just survival. To survive enslavement is an important act of resistance, but other times people were trying to grind up glass and put in Massa's drink. Other times they were trying to flee it as individuals, as the great Harriet Tubman did. Other times they were trying to flee and form maroon societies. And other times they were trying to have actual uprisings. And there were a lot of those. And if you don't know that, you can have this, mythical belief that black people just submitted to slavery and were happy slaves and going along with having all their wealth and life stolen and their spirits crushed and their families destroyed. And that's not true. And it actually reinforces sort of a white supremacist understanding of the world that has profound implications for today. But also, if you are trying to get free today, if you're a young person, I mean, I met a lot of young people, including at Johnson C. Smith University and other HBCUs, where they were talking about they didn't actually want to come hear about slave rebellion reenactment while I was making it happen because they thought it was about slavery and they didn't want to know why their ancestors were, they didn't want to hear more about their ancestors being slave. But when they heard that it was about slave rebellion and that there were a lot of slave rebellions, they're like, why don't we know this? And they wanted to shout about it. They wanted to tell other people. And so I think that question of how we get free today and who are going to be the freedom fighters today and who are going to be the descendants of the slave rebels today is a critical question for people that are trying to look at all the hell people are catching and are looking at, well, where does Black Lives Matter go? Well, I think, people should be studying these slave rebellions and see this uncompromising, no holds barred, we have to get free by any means necessary take that these rebels in 1811 had.
So much of your work, in my view, is not a rejection of American history as much as it is a reminder that this too is part and parcel of the American narrative, that stands in contradiction to that commitment to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And I'd like your thoughts on that.
Well, first off, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. The original draft of that was life, liberty, and the pursuit of wealth. And Jefferson was compelled to change that for various reasons. So they initially were talking about, look, we can make money here. And so, I mean, while I think it's a fair enough statement that my work is looking at U.S. history and is not critical of U.S. history, and I think that's, or I mean, it's critically looking at U.S. history, but it's not trying to get beyond it. Personally, I do not share any love for America. I think the American experiment was one that was founded in oppression and is something that we can get beyond. I don't, it's America is a real barrier to people getting free, both in this country but also around the world. And again, this vision of rooting our dreams of freedom in a document written by enslavers for a system that was about slavery, that's not, I mean, that's not a lofty vision. It's an outmoded, backwards-looking vision. We could do a lot better than that. And I think my art actually challenges and sometimes makes people uncomfortable, as we talked about earlier, to think about, well, why is it structural? I mean, there's an artwork that I did called "A Man Was Lynched by Police Yesterday," which is a banner that has white text and a black banner that references the NAACP banner that just said, "A man was lynched yesterday." They were doing that as part of an anti-lynching campaign to stop the scourge of lynching from, and they had it outside their national headquarters from 1920 to 1938, the day after anybody was lynched. And some people have said, well, actually, isn't it harsh to compare the police to lynch mobs? And I said, well, no, actually, it's not. You know, ask, you know, the mother of Tamir Rice, whether she felt the same fear and dread that Mamie Till, Emmett Till's mother felt. And we know actually that police kill people at five times the rate as were killed at the height of lynching. And so the terror that the police institute in black and brown communities is the same terror that lynch mobs all over the United States, you know, exercised on black people back in the day. And so, you know, this thing of looking at history is really important for me in my art, but I do it with a perspective of trying to challenge some of these foundational ideas, so hopefully people can get beyond America.
Well, as you were giving that answer, I was going back to the Kyle Rittenhouse and Tamir Rice and sort of juxtaposing those two and the response to those two. And one had a toy gun, one had a real gun.
So, you know, Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old child sitting by himself, not hurting nobody, just with a toy gun. Police show up, and 2 seconds later, he's dead. And Kyle Rittenhouse, a man who shot three people, killed two of them, drove across straight lines with a semi-automatic AR-15, and he gets patted on the back by the police and allowed to walk away. And so there you have it. That actually, glad you brought that up for me, because that actually tells you everything you need to know about this country.
You know, another thing about your work that struck me. I mean, I had a lot of reactions because your stuff reminds me of other stuff and just gets me going. And I actually wish we had more time than we actually do to be in conversation with you. But it also reminded me of a book by Cornell Professor Edward Baptist, and the title of the book is "The Half Has Not Been Told." A recount of many of the enslaved. And I see you uncomfortably reminding us, as I mentioned earlier, that this discomfort is a prerequisite for change. And you are presenting for the public a portion of that other half, maybe even more than that, but at least the other half, that has not been told, at least not with equal veracity. And I wonder, would that be a fair assessment of your work, or how do you see it?
Yeah, and actually, that's a really great book, and it talks about the history of slavery and looks at how slavery was integral to capitalism, and how the enslaved were worked relentlessly under capitalism, particularly looking at cotton, as the mechanism for it, which was not the only crop that the enslaved were forced to grow. But and in that book, I mean, the title of the book comes from a conversation that somebody historically was having with somebody who was enslaved, but it was during the time that they were free. And he was like, "Look, man, you don't know the half of it." And then Baptiste says, "Well, all right, I'm going to tell this story based on that." And I think and in the telling in the book, he talks about how the guy has seen all these coffles, which are basically black people being walked hundreds of miles to market in chains, and then sometimes loaded onto trains, and with just the meagerest of you know, possessions, and how they were, you know, almost walked to death. And this guy is like, "Look, I've seen all of this. If you don't know that, you don't know anything." And so I think that you know, I hope that in small ways to actually get people to know the history that sometimes they aren't comfortable looking at, and they should get more comfortable looking at, because it is actually history. And if you know, it's like, and particularly for, you know, particularly I will say to white people, if they think of themselves as, well, wait a minute, I don't want to look at this history because I didn't own slaves. I didn't have anything to do with that. It's like there was another book by Dennis Blackman who said something really insightful. It's like, look, and that book is Slavery by Another Name. And he said, look, this is not your fault, but it is your inheritance. And I think he meant that both in terms of the actual wealth that was generated, but also the problem based on that wealth. And so, no, it's like white people, nobody that's alive today probably directly owns slaves in the sense of chattel slavery. But the situation that we've all inherited, the particular people that are wealthy or have some modicum of wealth, and I don't even mean like billions and millions of dollars. I mean, if you're, white and your family got a, GI loan in the 40s, you've benefited from slavery. And so what do you do with that? Doesn't mean you feel guilty, but it does mean you need to acknowledge and get into that history of why the world is the way it did. If you look at police as somebody they're there to protect me, well, that's not how most black and brown communities look at them. They might want them to protect them. They might call them it sometimes, but it's like that's not, we every black family, when their child, if they have children, when they get to be 12 or 13 or 14 and get a little bit bigger, we talk with them about how to survive an encounter with the police. And so you need to look at this history, even if it makes you uncomfortable. And I think that that half that's never been told, both about slavery, but also about other resistance and other oppression, including about the police. I mean, I've done, several pieces of, because I've known people that have been killed, had family members killed by the police, and seeing the pain that that causes those families, and know that those one individual cases are tips of icebergs. And so, there's a lot to look at. This country is rotten at its foundations, and people need to be able to soberly confront that.
You mentioned the GI Bill. I mean, and even if you were an African American, there's another layer there, because even if you were African American and you returning soldier and you qualify for the GI Bill, at the local lending level, there were still banks that were redlining so that you were put in certain communities where your property value did not accumulate the same pace as someone else's property, maybe 2 miles down the road did.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, racism is woven into the fabric of America, and it continues to get rewoven. And talking about, this is like, okay, even if you qualify for a loan, you're not going to be in the suburbs. Your property value is going to be worth, you're going to pay higher interest rates, but your property is not going to accumulate value. And then your neighborhood's going to get blighted, and then there's services that won't be there, and then it's going to lose value. And so something that was a means to accumulate, middle class or even lower middle class lifestyle for a lot of white folk has been something that has just been a way to steal wealth out of black communities. And this is by design, not like one person or even one group of people sits in a room and says, ooh, let's figure out how to screw over black people today. But you look at the 2008 lending crisis that happened, where it was the largest transfer of wealth out of the black community since World War II that happened, where a couple of banks decided to give loans to people they knew could not afford them, and they were predominantly black. They paid higher interest rates, and then they stole their houses when they couldn't pay. And then the whole housing market collapsed, and the government, bailed them out, and we bailed them out. So it was basically the government saying, we're going to enshrine and enforce this particular version of racism, and we're going to enshrine and enforce this transfer of wealth, and the taxpayers are going to pay for it. And so then what do the people, what do quote unquote, we the people, which is, I think, a dangerous myth, but what do we do? Do we say, well, all right, we're just going to fall for that same okie doke again? Or right now, as we're seeing, where disgruntled white people who are having basically a fascist program marketed to them, and they're in some quantities embracing that. And it's the oldest game in the American book. Where broke as a joke, poor ass white folk are told to side with rich white folk against black people. And that's American history. It's like most white people didn't own slaves and weren't ever going to own slaves, but they were always told you could own slaves. And so you're going to side with Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and people who owned hundreds and hundreds of slaves and accumulated lots of money off the backs of enslaved labor, and going to perpetuate that system. And that game is being rejigged, and the rules are being slightly tweaked, but that's played over and over and over again. And that's what we're seeing, where You got gerrymandering maps where it's like, okay, let's draw the map around these places so that there's no way you can, ever challenge the rule of these now, this literally straight up fascist Republican Party.
Dred Scott, it has truly been an honor to be in conversation with you. I can't thank you for your time. Thank you so much, sir.
Well, thank you for having me.
The Public Morality welcomes your comments. You can contact me at byron@publicmorality.org. That's Byron, BYRON, at publicmorality.org. You can follow me on Facebook as well as Twitter. The archive broadcast can be found on iTunes, Spotify, Amazon Prime, and SoundCloud. Those listening to the Public Morality on WSNC can now listen on its app. Using your mobile device, simply go to your application page, search WSNC 90.5, and click open to listen from anywhere. And once again, I want to thank Elvin Jenkins and Michael Burns at WGAB in Huntsville, Alabama, for allowing us to broadcast the Public Morality at their studios. The Public Morality is produced at WSNC on the campus of Winston-Salem State University. For all of us at the Public Morality, I'm Byron Williams.